UK were about 4%. In America, they're 20% with this insured model. We're now at the last, there was a secret study done. It's not been published. It's been available through leaks in various places. I think we're up to about 14%. Yeah. But where we're heading to is 20% of the cost going into management. In other words, going back up to
that is very
top.
Worrying indeed. And just as we end near the end of the show, I'd just like to discuss one of the key messages of this documentary, which is the power of ordinary citizens, I suppose, to rise up and to challenge the 1%. Clive, do you think? I'm sorry, Rich. Do you think that this documentary ends on a hopeful note?
I mean, so many of these documentaries that make you angry end up by saying, you know, vote, use your vote, get out and protest, and. You know, that message has been going on for, we're 10 years into this economic system, this new world that we're living in, and it's not getting any better. It's getting worse. So,
just your final thoughts on the film now.
Yeah, so I think the film helps raise issues that need to be raised, and we need to watch these kinds of films so that we understand what's going on, and maybe that will help us use our vote more wisely and get out and protest where it's effective. But it does kind of make you feel a little hopeless.
I'm afraid we'll have to end it on a sad note there, but I wish we could talk more, but we've run out of time. Thank you very much. And that's it for this episode of Doc Review. Thank you again to both my guests and to you. I've been Camilla Shambiati.
What about you? IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Limelight. New findings by researchers re-emphasize the importance of short-range COVID transmission, with physical distancing and mask wearing likely to be the most effective means of preventing infection. Ventilation, though still worthwhile, is likely to have a lesser impact. we'll prepare for you an article written by Linda Geddes. The piece is titled, Study Says COVID Loses 90% of Ability to Infect Within Minutes in Air. The world's first simulations of how the coronavirus survives in exhaled air suggest coronavirus loses 90% of its ability to infect us within 20 minutes of becoming airborne, with most of the loss occurring within the first 5 minutes. The findings re-emphasize the importance of short-range COVID transmission, with physical distancing and mask-wearing likely to be the most effective means of preventing infection. Ventilation, though still worthwhile, is likely to have a lesser impact. Professor Jonathan Reed, director of the University of Bristol's Aerosol Research Centre and the study's lead author, said, "People have been focused on poorly ventilated spaces and thinking about airborne transmission over meters or across a room. I'm not saying that doesn't happen, but I think still the greatest risk of exposure is when you're close to someone," adding, "When you move further away, not only is the aerosol diluted down, there's also less infectious virus because the virus has lost infectivity as a result of time. Until now, our assumptions about how long the virus survives in tiny airborne droplets have been based on studies that involve spraying virus into sealed vessels called Goldberg drums, which rotate to keep the droplets airborne. Using this method, US researchers found the infectious virus could still be detected after 3 hours. Yet such experiments do not accurately replicate what happens when we cough or when we breathe. Instead, researchers from the University of Bristol developed apparatus that allowed them to generate any number of tiny virus-containing particles and gently levitate them between two electric rings for anywhere between 5 seconds to 20 minutes, while tightly controlling the temperature, humidity and UV light intensity of their surroundings. Professor Jonathan Reed said, "This is the first time anyone has been able to actually simulate what happens to the aerosol during the exhalation process." The study, which has not yet been peer-reviewed, suggested that as the viral particles leave the relatively moist and carbon dioxide-rich conditions of the lungs, they rapidly lose water and dry out, while the transition to lower levels of carbon dioxide is associated with a rapid increase in pH. Both of these factors disrupt the virus's ability to infect human cells, but the speed at which the particles dry out varies according to the relative humidity of the surrounding air. When this was lower than 50%, similar to relatively dry air found in many offices, the virus has lost around half of its infectivity within 5 seconds, after which the decline was slower and more steady, with a further 19% loss over the next 5 minutes. At 90% humidity, roughly equivalent to a steam or shower room, the decline in infectivity was more gradual, with 52% of particles remaining infectious after 5 minutes, dropping to about 10% after 20 minutes, after which there was no difference between the two conditions. However, the temperature of the air made no difference to viral infectivity, contradicting the widely held belief that the viral transmission is lower at high temperatures. Professor Jonathan Reed said, "It means that if I'm meeting friends for lunch, the primary risk is likely to be transmitting it to my friends or my friends transmitting it to me, rather than it being transmitted from someone on the other side of the room." Adding, "This highlights the importance of wearing a face mask in situations where people cannot physically distance. Julian Tang, a clinical virologist at the University of Leicester in England, said the findings support what epidemiologists have been observing on the ground, adding that face masks are very effective, as well as social distancing. Improved ventilation will also help, particularly if this is close to the source. Dr. Stephen Griffin, associate professor of virology at the University of Leeds, emphasized the importance of ventilation, saying aerosols will fill up indoor spaces rapidly in the absence of proper ventilation. So, assuming the infected individual remains within the room, the levels of virus will be replenished. The same effects were seen across all three SARS-CoV-2 variants the team has tested so far, including the Alpha variant. They hope to start experiments with the Omicron variant in the coming weeks. The pandemic has been awash with slogans, but in recent weeks, two have been repeated with increasing frequency. Variants will evolve to be milder, and COVID will become endemic. Yet experts warn that neither of these things can be taken for granted. Those stating that viruses become less deadly over time often cite influenza. Both of the flu viruses responsible for the 1918 Spanish flu and the 2009 swine flu pandemics eventually evolved to become less dangerous. However, the 1918 virus is thought to have become more deadly before it became milder. And other viruses, such as Ebola, have become more dangerous over time. Professor David Robertson, head of the Viral Genomics and Bioinformatics at the University of Glasgow Centre for Virus Research, said, "It's a fallacy that viruses or pathogens become milder if the virus can continue to be transmitted and cause lots of disease. It certainly will. Viruses aim to create as many copies of themselves and spread as widely as possible, although it is not always in their best interest to kill their hosts. So long as they are transmitted before this happens, it doesn't matter. SARS-CoV-2 doesn't kill people during the period when it is most infectious. People tend to die 2 or 3 weeks after becoming ill. Provided it does not evolve to make people so ill that they do not or cannot mix with other people while they're infectious, the virus doesn't care if there are some casualties along the way. Neither is it clear that the SARS-CoV-2 is becoming progressively milder. Omicron variant appears to be less severe and the Alpha or Delta variants, but both of these variants cause more severe illness than the original Wuhan strain. Importantly, viral evolution is not a one-way street. Omicron did not evolve from Delta, and Delta didn't evolve from Alpha. It is more random and unpredictable than that. Robertson says these variants of concern are not going one from the other, and so if the pattern continues and another variant pops out in 6 months' time, it will be worse, adding, "It's time not to assume that there's some inevitability for Omicron to be the end of the SARS-CoV-2 evolution." There is a possibility that Omicron is so transmissible that it has hit a ceiling, whereby future variants will struggle to outcompete it. But just a few months ago, people were saying the same thing about the Delta variant. Also, Omicron is likely to keep evolving. Robertson says, "What might play out is that as Omicron infects so many people, it's harder for the first Omicron variant to continue to be as successful, and so that creates a space for a virus that's better at evading the immune response." What about the idea that SARS-CoV-2 could become endemic? Politicians tend to use this as a proxy for getting on with our lives and forgetting that COVID-19 exists. What endemic actually means is a disease that's consistently present, but where rates of infection are predictable and not spiraling out of control. Stephen Griffin, Associate Professor of Virology at the University of Leeds, says, "Smallpox was endemic. Polio is endemic. Lassa fever is endemic. And malaria is endemic," adding, "Measles and mumps are endemic, but dependent on vaccination. Endemic does not mean that something loses its teeth at all."
Wildfires in Greece, Turkey, the United States.
Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to engage in hunger strikes.
Kim Yo-jong, the powerful sister of North Korean leader.
On the news line.
As the Saudi war in Yemen rages on, clashes and cross-border strikes have escalated in the past few weeks. The kingdom, which relies almost entirely on foreign-made weapons in the war, is said to be running low on interceptor missiles. An American official tells Financial Times that Riyadh may have only months until it runs out of missiles for its US-made Patriot missile systems. According to the official, the kingdom has asked its allies for loans and pleaded with the US to replenish its stock. Almost 7 years after the Yemen war started, cracks are now showing in Saudi Arabia's military campaign against Yemen. On Saturday, the Saudi-led coalition played footage during a press conference that purportedly showed ballistic missiles stored at Yemen's vital Hodeidah port. The coalition spokesperson, Turki al-Maliki, said the footage means Hodeidah and Salif ports are legitimate targets since they're being used as military bases. The Yemenis, however, were quick to identify the footage. They say it's taken from an American documentary film about Iraq and has nothing to do with Yemen.
If you go to Al Arabiya, they claim that the Saudis just had major military victories against the Yemenis, who they call Houthis, and a victory is within strike. It's like watching a bad production of 1984, really, what comes out of the telescreen, constant victories, or the TV news in the 60s in the United States during the Vietnam War.
In response, the Yemeni Foreign Ministry said the coalition's pretexts for targeting the country's ports are mere theatrical posturing and aimed at legitimizing the aggression.
This war has to end. And to underscore our commitment, we are ending all American support for offensive operations in the war in Yemen, including relevant arms sales.
The U.S. president made the pledge back in February last year. He touted the move as part of efforts to restore an emphasis on human rights. Biden, however, said Washington will continue to support and help Riyadh. The peace activists who hailed his announcement are now dismayed at his administration for going back on the promise. Back in September, the U.S. State Department approved its first major arms sale to the kingdom under President Biden, with a sale of 280 air-to-air missiles valued at up to $650 million. A State Department spokesperson defended the sale as, quote, "fully consistent with the administration's pledge to lead with diplomacy to end the conflict in Yemen."
Biden administration had actually run on a promise to put an end to the war in Yemen. You could actually do that in a heartbeat, by grounding the AWACS that support the Saudi airstrikes against Yemen. Those are entirely within the control of the Pentagon, and Biden is the commander-in-chief, so if he ordered no support for the bombing raids, AWACS and other guidance information, then that would be the end of the war.
President Biden has broken another promise about defending humanitarian rights, an issue he's staked much of his presidency on. Back in February, a declassified U.S. intelligence report concluded that Saudi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman authorized a team of Saudi security and intelligence officials to kill dissident journalist Jamal Khashoggi. But Biden later decided not to punish bin Salman, saying it would be diplomatically unprecedented for the United States. Before he took office, though, the U.S. was considering removing four batteries of the Patriot missile system from the Saudi oil facilities.
They've been encircling Russia and China pretty much since the end of the Second World War, and they are now pretty much up at the borders around both of them with more military assets than have ever existed before. Some of these assets in other parts of the world, including the 30 or 40,000 troops that have been deployed out of the Middle East, are most likely being focused on China.
As Washington's focus changes from West Asia to Eurasia, what will happen to its regional allies like Riyadh? The U.S. takes in stride the violations perpetrated by its allies while accusing countries it deems its adversaries of the same charges. Wouldn't that embolden those officials to commit even worse crimes, knowing that they can get away with murder in the most literal sense?
Escalating tensions between Moscow and Western countries, namely the United States, in recent months have prompted security talks over issues straining bilateral relations. Russian and American diplomats meet for talks in the Swiss city of Geneva. The talks are aimed at a wide-ranging new security arrangement between Russia and the West. The Kremlin demands guarantees that NATO will not expand further eastward by granting membership to ex-Soviet Ukraine. The U.S.-led NATO military alliance claims Moscow is building up troops on its border with the intention to attack Ukraine. Moscow denies the allegations, emphasizing that it can move its troops around within its own borders as it sees fit. On the other hand, Russia has long complained about existing U.S. missile defense capabilities based in southern Romania. Also, a second installation in northern Poland is nearly complete and projected to be operational by the end of this year. Moscow has recently voiced concerns that Washington would also seek to base missiles in Ukraine, which could be used for offensive purposes as well.
There was always a threat to Russia. NATO has traditionally, more specifically during the last few years, had a very hostile attitude towards Russia, and therefore they felt justifiably threatened.
The situation prompted Moscow to table a set of security proposals, which included curbs on NATO expansion and security guarantees for Russia. Some of these demands have already been rejected by the U.S. and its allies, as both NATO and Washington have said that the alliance would never promise not to expand. Russia's Deputy Foreign Minister Sergei Ryabkov held a meeting with his American counterpart, Deputy Secretary of State Wendy Sherman, in Geneva on Sunday. He described the initial talks with Washington on security guarantees as stunning, but also noted that the conversation was difficult. Russia rules out any concession at security talks with the U.S., warning that the talks on the Ukraine crisis might end early. Meanwhile, the U.S. says no breakthroughs are expected and that progress depends on the escalation from Moscow. The Russians are also scheduled to hold similar high-level discussions with NATO and Europeans. In December, Moscow set out its security demands in two documents, a proposed treaty with the U.S. and an agreement with NATO. Essentially, Russia now wants guarantees that NATO will halt its eastward expansion, rule out membership for Ukraine and other former Soviet countries, and roll back its military deployments in Central and Eastern Europe. U.S. and its NATO allies, meanwhile, have already said they will not accede to Russia's demands. They have already rejected a demand for the removal of all U.S. nuclear weapons stationed in Europe, and also flatly ruled out Moscow's demand for a guarantee that Ukraine and Georgia will never join NATO. Russia considers this expansion as a direct threat to its national security. Also, NATO Secretary General Jens Stoltenberg says the alliance and Russia could still find a political solution for their differences. Stoltenberg reiterated the alliance wasn't ready to discuss guarantees that it won't expand eastward to meet Moscow's demands, saying that would breach NATO's core principles. But he said the US and NATO were prepared to speak about possible risk reduction measures like arms control, on efforts to try to have more transparency on military activity, exercises, and also on lines of communications.
Western forces puts NATO on the border of Russia, and this is what is creating the danger. This is really the only thing that is creating the danger, and to a large extent, Russian actions have been a reaction against the more hostile and the more aggressive policy of NATO in expanding and in meeting the demands of even the smaller countries who are really obsessed with Russia at the cost of agreements and comity between Russia and NATO.
Russian President Vladimir Putin has previously warned that Moscow will act if the U.S.-led NATO military alliance crosses its red lines in Ukraine. Putin said the expansion of NATO military infrastructure in Ukraine was a red line he hoped would not be crossed. Kazakhstan faces its worst violence experienced since the independence of the Central Asian country in the early 1990s as the Soviet Union collapsed. Dozens of people have died while public buildings across the country have been looted and torched over the past week. It all began with fuel reforms that took effect on January 1, 2022, leading to the doubling of liquefied petroleum gas prices.
Simple events, increasing prices for liquid gas, which most people in Kazakhstan using as a fuel for cars and as a fuel for heating the houses, that was a trigger that kind of event.
Following that, demonstrations began in the western Manjistau province on Sunday, but then spread across the country and turned violent, resulting in clashes between protesters and security forces. Kazakh President Kasym-Jomart Tokayev's response included accepting the resignation of the government and announcing fixed fuel prices, but also ordering a crackdown. The unrest prompted Tokayev to appeal for help from the Collective Security Treaty Organization to restore peace and security. The Collective Security Treaty Organization is a Russian-led alliance of former Soviet states including Russia, Belarus, Tajikistan, Armenia, Kyrgyzstan, and Kazakhstan. Tokayev blames foreign-trained terrorists for the unrest. He describes a large proportion of the protesters as criminals, saying 20,000 bandits were involved in the unrest in Almaty, Kazakhstan's largest city and the center of the recent unrest. Consequently, he has authorized security forces to open fire without warning in case of further unrest. Initial peaceful protests appear to have been subverted by seemingly well-organized groups of rioters, particularly on Wednesday when the police seemed to leave key installations in the city unprotected. The unrest is seen as an attempt by foreign parties to provoke color revolutions in the ex-Soviet country, modeled on the Rose Revolution in Georgia and the Orange Revolution in Ukraine, which Russia has blamed on the West as an attempt to undermine the security of Kazakhstan.
Obviously, some game of the superpower and Western interference and covert operations always exist.
Russia's top envoy in the U.S., Anatoly Antonov, blames Washington's foreign policy for helping to provoke the crisis in Kazakhstan. Antonov says the root cause of the mayhem is the destabilization in the Middle East and Afghanistan, caused in turn by 2 decades of U.S. military intervention across Western and Central Asia under the pretext of defending human rights and democracy. Russia says the reason behind its decision to provide military support for Kazakhstan is reaffirming its commitment to allied obligations within the Collective Security Treaty Organization. In addition, Moscow views the recent developments in Kazakhstan as externally provoked attempts at disrupting the security and integrity of the state through violent means, including trained and organized armed groups. Russia also slammed U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken as boorish for saying Kazakhstan would be settled with Russian presence after asking Moscow to send in troops. This came after Blinken told reporters on Friday
that I think one lesson of recent history is that once Russians are in your house, it's sometimes very difficult to get them to leave.
Moscow ramped up the criticism further, also going on to cite a number of Washington's invasions, interventions, and military occupations over the decades, suggesting Blinken might learn a history lesson of his own. It mentioned unfortunate people who had the bad luck to see these uninvited guests at their doorstep, naming Native Americans, Koreans, Vietnamese, and Syrians, among others.
But Russia has much better track record than United States, because United States has about 800 military objects and bases around the globe, and staying unwelcome in a lot of countries.
Russian President Vladimir Putin and his Kazakh counterpart, Kasym-Jomart Tokayev, held a phone conversation to discuss the ongoing unrest in Kazakhstan on Saturday. The two discussed steps to restore order in the country. Tokayev also informed Putin in detail about the situation in the country, noting that it is developing towards a stabilization.
On January 3, 2020, the United States assassinated Iran's Lieutenant General Qasem Soleimani alongside the deputy commander of Iraq's Popular Mobilization Unit, Abu Mahdi al-Muhandis, in a drone strike at the Baghdad airport.
When American democracy is a complete sham, as it was under Trump, and it reached its apotheosis, you could say, with the assassination of a great anti-ISIS fighter, really the main force that was fighting ISIS.
5 days later, Iran launched a barrage of ballistic missiles at Iraq's Ain al-Assad air base housing U.S. troops in retaliation for the assassination, leaving scores of casualties. The Pentagon downplayed the number of troops injured in the strike, but later admitted that over 100 of its personnel suffered traumatic brain injuries. One died by suicide in October.
See, this is probably what Pompeo and Trump were counting on. They thought, oh, well, we'll kill the Soleimani, and then maybe Iran will attack us, and that will give us an excuse to go to war against Iran. I'm sure that was their plan, you didn't do that. That was it's very wise. When you're dealing with an enraged bull, you don't poke it. You go around it, you figure out where its weak spots are, you do that kind of strategizing.
This is what the head of the United States Central Command has told a New Yorker journalist about the airstrike on Ain al-Assad Air Base.
They hit pretty much where they wanted to hit. They can strike effectively across the breadth and the depth of the Middle East. They could strike with accuracy, and they could strike with volume.
The American general has admitted that Iran's missile capabilities have given the Islamic Republic overmatch, a military term meaning a level of military prowess where the country can overwhelm the enemy by a significant margin. Last August, the Taliban swept to power in Afghanistan in a matter of weeks and seized control of the capital, Kabul, while the U.S. troops were still present in the country. Observers believe the United States' withdrawal from the Central Asian country will go down in history as one of the most chaotic moves Washington has ever made. But a senior commander of Iran's Islamic Revolution Guards Corps says Americans will have to leave Iraq in a more humiliating manner than the way they left Afghanistan. The commander of the IRGC's Quds Force said the Americans are facing various problems in the region while a resistance front is advancing on a daily basis. Brigadier General Ismail Ghani noted that the resistance fighters are now equipped with missiles and weapons that can target U.S. warships anywhere in the region. The senior commander said Americans will be finally uprooted from the region. He made the remarks at a ceremony in the Iranian city of Mashhad on the second anniversary of the U.S. assassination of Iran's top general Qasem Soleimani and senior Iraqi commander Abu Mateh al-Muhandis.
I don't know. You ask if the U.S. has got the message. Well, sometimes people or nations are so foolish that they go to such an point with their mistaken agenda that it just collapses completely. So that seems to be what's going to happen. I don't know when it will happen, but there seems to be very little possibility of a rational U.S. government.
Despite the United States and its allies' repeated threats, Iran has proven its ability to make good on its promise to mete out a crushing response to any possible aggressor.
Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Limelight. Reports grow of repeat coronavirus infection as experts warn prevalence among Britain's school pupils puts older people at risk. We have prepared for you an article written by Linda Geddes. The piece is titled, Without COVID-19 Jab, Reinfection May Occur Every 16 Months. The article has been published by the British newspaper The Guardian. COVID-19 infections surge in England, people are increasingly reporting catching SARS-CoV-2 for a second or even a third time. New analysis has suggested that unvaccinated individuals should expect to be reinfected with COVID-19 every 16 months on average. With winter approaching, scientists are warning that such reinfections could add to the burden of the National Health Service. Some calling for the vaccination program to be extended to all school children, including two doses for teenagers. Stephen Griffin, Associate Professor of Virology at the University of Leeds, says, if you've got high-level prevalence and frequent exposure to the virus as you have in schools, you're going to see more and more people getting reinfected despite having been double vaccinated. This time last year, the assumption was that although reinfections could occur, this was relatively uncommon, with only 24 or so recorded worldwide. We now know that natural immunity to SARS-CoV-2 begins to dwindle over time. One Danish study suggested that the under-65s had about 80% protection for at least 6 months, while the over-65s had only 47% protection. The arrival of the Delta variant of the coronavirus has further complicated the situation. Danny Altman, Professor of Immunology at Imperial College, London, says, Certainly, in the healthcare workers that we've been studying, there are many people who had moderately decent levels of antibodies, who have been, in some cases, previously infected and double-dose vaccinated, who have gone down with symptomatic infections. He added, I think it is far more common than the kinds of numbers we were used to before. Office of National Statistics data published on 6th of October says that among 20,262 Britons who tested positive for COVID-19 between July of 2020 and September of 2021, there were 296 reinfections. Defined as a new positive test 120 days or more after an initial first positive test, with an average median time of 203 days between positive tests. However, the reinfection risk appears to have been higher since May of 2021, when Delta variant of the coronavirus took over as the predominant variant. Further data from the United States, where various states have now started tracking and reporting on reinfection rates, supports the idea there is a substantially higher risk of reinfection with the Delta variant of the coronavirus. In Oklahoma, which has a population of about 3.9 million, there were 5,229 reinfections reported during September, equivalent to a reinfection rate of 1,152 per 100,000 of the population. And reinfections have risen 350% since May. The U.S. Center for Disease Control and Prevention, the CDC, defines reinfection as a laboratory-confirmed case of COVID-19 occurring 90 days or more after a previously lab-confirmed case. Dr. Nasreen Alwan, Associate Professor in Public Health at the University of Southampton, says, with rising levels of SARS-CoV-2 infections in the United Kingdom, many of us are personally aware of children and adults who got reinfected, sometimes after a relatively short period from their first infection. Dr. Alwan says, we still don't know much about the risk factors for reinfection, but the theoretical assumption that once all the young get it, the pandemic will be over is becoming increasingly unlikely. To help answer this question, Professor Jeffrey Townsend and colleagues at Yale University School of Medicine analyzed known reinfection and immunological data from other coronaviruses, including those that cause SARS, MERS, and common colds. By combining this with antibody and other immunological data from people who had recovered from SARS-CoV-2, they were able to model the risk of COVID-19 reinfection over time. The research published in The Lancet Microbe suggested that reinfections would become increasingly common as immunity waned, particularly when the number of infections was high. Professor Townsend says, if we had no infection controls, no one was masking or social distancing, there were no vaccines, we should expect reinfection on a 3-month to 5-year timescale, meaning that the average person should expect to get COVID every 3 months to 5 years. Although vaccines are suppressing the level of infections, the United Kingdom reported 49,156 COVID cases on Monday, 18th of October. The highest figure since mid-July. Rates are highest among secondary school children, but an estimated 8.1% of this group thought to have had COVID-19 in the week ending 9th of October. Professor Townsend added, if you allow it to run amok in any age group, then it runs amok in all age groups, adding, the major implications are that if you haven't been vaccinated, you should get vaccinated. And if you've been infected, you should go ahead and get vaccinated anyway, because that will extend the duration of your protection. Griffin says, if you don't clamp down, on prevalence in school children, you get the spread of infection and possibly reinfection, which will then potentially spread to parents whose vaccines may be waning, and more critically to grandparents and clinically vulnerable people. Meanwhile, all children in the United Kingdom over the age of 12 are now eligible for at least one COVID jab, and possibly two, depending on age and other factors such as their health. But the pace of the vaccine rollout has come in for some criticism. According to official figures, jab rates among 12 to 15-year-olds are three times lower in England than Scotland, with a rate about 14% for the former and 44% for the latter. This could be important, not least because the latest data from the Office for National Statistics, ONS, shows infections have shot up among secondary school children, with an estimated 8.1% of this group in England thought to have had COVID in the week ending 9th of October. However, when it comes to schools, it is also worth noting that a number of interventions have been dropped, including the use of face masks in secondary schools in England. By contrast, the Scottish Government has confirmed pupils should continue to wear face masks in school after October half-term. Professor Andrew Hayward, an epidemiologist at the University College London, speaking in a personal capacity, says, "The rates are highest and increasing most in school children, a group with intense mixing at school, no real mask use, low vaccine coverage, and minimum attempts to prevent transmission." While Professor Andrew Hayward noted this group was very unlikely to develop severe illness, Kao noted infections in young people could spill over to other groups. Kao says, "Vaccination of teenagers is likely to be more important for tracking the rise in infections due to the very high number of teenage cases right now, a very different picture to earlier pandemic waves. In the past, new variants have fueled large surges in COVID cases. The Alpha variant played a key role in rising cases last winter, while the Delta variant led to upticks in the spring. Now it seems a new variant is in play in England. More specifically, it seems this could be an offshoot of the Delta variant, which is dominant in the United Kingdom. According to the latest variant technical briefing from the United Kingdom Health Security Agency, a Delta sublineage, newly designated as AY.4.2, is noted to be expanding in England, with the body noting it is being monitored and assessed. The agency added that in the week beginning 27th of September, the last week for which complete sequencing data was available, the AY4.2 accounted for about 6% of sequenced coronavirus cases and is on an increasing trajectory. However, Professor Francois Balou, the director of the University College London Genetics Institute, says the new variant was unlikely to be behind the recent rise in cases. He says its potential higher transmissibility could at this stage only explain a tiny fraction of additional cases. He added, "It's around 10% frequency now, and assuming it may be 10% more transmissible, that would only explain an additional 1% extra infections every 5 or so days."
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Puraza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Amin Olemi, Kabul.
Shahana Bhatt, Indian Administered Kashmir.
Round the World with Reporters.
Ever since the Great Recession began, decreased purchasing power has been the number one complaint of French voters. Because one in four Frenchmen suffers from a serious housing problem, Emmanuel Macron made better and more housing a central plank of his 2017 presidential campaign. Today, inflation just hit record highs in France and across the Eurozone, and housing has become even more expensive during the coronavirus crisis. A recent poll showed that 3 out of 4 French people feels that their purchasing power has diminished, and 90% of the country is concerned about it. While the elite may be able to afford these higher costs, it's clear that the rest of France is deeply concerned. Top NGOs and some unions gathered in Paris to warn all candidates that recent years have seen untold socioeconomic damage, which could result in more political upheavals.
And this is the reason why these organizations have come together to be able to raise a cry of alarm and try and intervene in the campaign.
Affordable housing has long established fixes. Write laws which favor tenants and not landlords. Put more tax revenue into building new housing and create more shelters for those with emergency needs. The Macron era has implemented none of these solutions, which has allowed the price of real estate to cross the records of 10,000 euros per square meter in Paris and 3,000 euros nationwide. Inflated or not, real estate must be heated in winter, and record energy prices has the government already admitting they are worried about the social fallout which soaring prices could cause, as in 2018 with the Yellow Vests.
In the election, socioeconomic questions will be very prevalent because inequalities have gotten so much worse in recent years. Households are either having major problems paying their bills or simply getting evicted. The current government has made no initiatives to remedy these problems, especially regarding housing.
Some believe that housing is for living in, and some believe that housing is for investment speculation. But in a French election dominated by right-wingers, the leading candidates will be forced to at least pay lip service to the idea of state-sponsored remedies to soaring prices. Paris.
Families waiting outside the All India Institute of Medical Sciences. For hundreds, sometimes more, this bus stop is the stopover, perhaps a waiting area. All they wait for is the appointment with doctors. Few I spoke with don't care about the new COVID outbreak, and many are even confused what it is and what it does. They say our loved ones are dying anyway, due to lack of treatments and medical assistance. Coronavirus cases driven by the new Omicron variant have skyrocketed in India, prompting the government to rapidly reinforce a series of restrictions. The administration of Prime Minister Modi says it is confident and fully geared up to handle any situation in the wake of new COVID outburst, largely driven by Omicron variant. Health experts, however, have urged the government to halt the ongoing election campaigns, which they say could spark another healthcare crisis in the country. On Tuesday, the country recorded 168,000 new infections, including 4,400 cases of Omicron variant. 227 deaths were also reported, based on official data. The overall COVID case tally has increased to around 35 million, while the death count rose close to 480,000. And overall recoveries stand at 34.5 million. We take things slightly, as usual, and we saw the result in April. Many people think this Omicron is nothing new, but we need to be cautious. Despite alarming rise in fresh COVID cases, the political parties are busy with election rallies ahead of crucial state polls in 5 key Indian states of Uttar Pradesh, Punjab, Uttarakhand, Goa, and Manipur, which begins February 10. Rallies packed with thousands of people, many without masks, is making health experts worried.
We have learned from first and second wave, and even if we see the private and the public sectors in health sector basically in India, so everyone have leveled up their care practices, and they are also providing the specialized care for the COVID.
Over the last 2 weeks, hospital admissions are rising and medical staff has been advised to cut their leaves. New Delhi, Maharashtra, Rajasthan and parts of southern India are reporting maximum cases, including the new variant. Earlier waves of the pandemic unfolded mayhem in the subcontinent. Healthcare collapsed. People begged for oxygen and hospital beds. Graveyards and crematoriums ran out of space. Munawar Zaman, New Delhi.
The pandemic appears to be spiraling out of control in the United States, pushing the country into uncharted territory. Many states are witnessing a dramatic surge in infections. Just in a single day, two new records have been set, sounding the alarm about the severity of the situation. Authorities are now reporting more than 1.3 million additional cases. That's the highest daily total of any nation in the world. The previous record set last week was just a little above 1 million. The 7-day average has also been soaring in recent weeks. It's now over 700,000 cases a day, 3 times higher than 2 weeks ago. Deaths have also increased, averaging around 1,700 per day. That's 20% up from 1,400 posted in recent days. Omicron is largely to blame for the rise. The extremely contagious variant is spreading like wildfire in many parts of the world, and the US is no exception. It's the world's worst-hit nation by far, with around 62 million cases and over 800,000 deaths. Vaccine maker Pfizer says a redesigned vaccine is likely needed to specifically target Omicron. U.S. medical centers are already overwhelmed, and the Omicron wave is now pushing them to the brink. The number of daily hospitalizations has hit a new peak. Over 140,000 more patients are being treated in hospitals whose staff have already been worn out by the Delta variant. Experts are of the opinion that many Americans' refusal to get their shots is probably one key factor stoking the spike. About 37% of the population has not been fully vaccinated. Some cities like Chicago and New York are imposing restrictions and vaccination rules to curb the trend, the kind of measures that are likely to once more bring anti-vaxxers onto the streets. Whatever the causes may be, the facts speak for themselves. The battle against the coronavirus is a tough one, and the U.S., already the number one in many global categories, has now one more to add to its records, the world's number one in its failure against the virus.
As Afghans are struggling with a rising hunger combined with harsh winter, the Iranian embassy in Kabul, in cooperation with the Imam Khomeini Relief Foundation, distributes rounds of aid in food to vulnerable people across Afghanistan.
Iran's humanitarian aid to the Afghan people is continuing in different provinces of Afghanistan. In the capital, Kabul, we aim to provide vulnerable families with food and warm clothes. Today, these batches of relief assistance, including flour, oil, and rice, are going to be distributed among Afghan teachers and unemployed people.
Unemployment, cash shortage, and the rise in prices have switched many to poverty and hunger. Nowadays, as winter sets in, millions of Afghans are awaiting relief assistance.
We're absolutely in need of such aid. I have a family of 10. We thank Iranian people for helping us in this dire situation. Their aid can help us survive one more month. We also demand Islamic countries and the international community to support us in this harsh winter, as we are short of food and warm shelter.
I'm a teacher and have 8 children. My husband is jobless. I have been unpaid for 4 months. Nowadays, we really don't have anything to eat or heat our houses. Other teachers have the same difficult situation. What should we do if we don't rely on foreign aid? I hope such aid continues for all throughout this winter.
Iran has delivered 14 rounds of aid to the people of Afghanistan since the Taliban took over and the financial crisis in August. This comes as nearly $10 billion in Afghan assets remain frozen by the U.S., and a large number of funds to the country are halted. harsh winter in Afghanistan is worsening the dire situation, adding to the number of people in need. Most families are relying on such assistance because it is a matter of survival for them. Rahmatullah Baghban, Kabul.
On January 9th last year, the Hassan family of Somali origin living